Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning show, heard exclusively here on WEEB. This is Taking Aim. I am Steve Woodward, and joining me is our favorite co-host, David Hensley. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Steve. It's been a while.
Welcome back. You're looking very healthy and tanned and rested.
Yes, sir. I've been gallivanting around the world, eating all the healthy food that the world has to offer that's difficult to find in the United States.
Yes, well, you're doing the Lord's work, and we thank you for that. And we're also happy that you're back. And we've got big news to talk about, which you were directly involved with this week. Before we get going, I wouldn't be remiss if I did not acknowledge our beloved sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. Since 1980, your go-to for breakfast, including their fabulous burritos, lunch, and now dinner, Monday through Thursday, 4 to 8 p.m., dinner at the Marketplace. Put it on your list. And, of course, for all your catering needs, for the small intimate office gathering to the wedding of the century, the Marketplace, since 1980. Coming up, we will be conversing with Keisha Brassington, who is North Carolina's representative within the Republican National Committee and the president of a new project called the Women's Leadership Initiative, which she will tell us about in depth when we speak to her later in the program. I want to remind you that there's a couple of items on our radar coming up. The Lincoln-Reagan-Trump dinner, sponsored by the Moore County Republican Party, is scheduled for May the 12th. At the Country Club of North Carolina, the keynote speaker is the best-selling author Peter Schweizer, the author of the current bombshell, The Invisible Coup. You heard from Peter on this program last week. We had a lengthy conversation about the findings of his book. Go to moregop.com for tickets to the big dinner on the 12th. And then coming up on May 15th, North Carolina Faith and Freedom Coalition is hosting a stop of the Bold and Courageous Tour in Asheboro, which will feature Pastor Rob McCoy, who is best known as the pastor and mentor of the late Charlie Kirk. You can learn more about this event on May the 15th, emceed by Representative Neil Jackson. Go to ncfaithandfreedom.com. to purchase your tickets, which are very reasonable, starting at $10 per person. David Hensley was in the room earlier this week when the Moore County Board of Education took a step that many of us thought would never come, which was to resolve somewhat of a crisis regarding our campus security in our public schools, particularly the 13 elementary schools, which have no armed security during any school day at any time. But things took a turn, and David is here to tell us about it. And I guess the headline is that starting in 2027, our public schools will be covered by personnel under the direction of the Moore County Sheriff's Department.
That's 100% correct, and that has been a goal of mine for 5 years. I've been very vocal about it. I started this jihad in January of 2022 when I discovered that in a school board meeting, because I asked questions, I discovered that our SROs, through no fault of the SROs themselves. This is a leadership failure. This is a, you know, superintendent and chief of police, then chief of police failure. But I found out in January of 2022 that our SROs had never, ever, ever had trauma medical training, nor did they have trauma medical kits. And I also discovered that they had not been participating in active shooter training for a number of years. I believe the number was 5 years that they had not, in 2022, had not had any active shooter training since 2017. And that's particularly crazy because, Steve, do you know where the North Carolina facility for active shooter training is located?
It's just up the road, isn't it?
It is actually in Moore County, in the Samarkand Training Facility. Out, yes. You just drive past West End a few miles, and it's right there.
Yeah.
So in 2022, look, the primary mission, here's the reason SROs were established. After the shooting in Columbine, you know, which was horrible. I mean, it was horrific, right?
Yes.
People demanded that we have, armed officers in place to protect our faculty, staff, and students. So the primary mission of school resource officers is to protect the lives of our faculty, staff, and students. And then, God forbid that it happen, deal with the aftermath by delivering trauma medical training. Now, there's secondary missions, role models, leaders, stuff like that. But that is their primary mission. And again, in 2022, I discovered that Moore County School Police, I mean, some of the officers had it just because they had it, before they joined the force. But the Moore County School Police never offered trauma medical training. Our guys did not, and gals did not have IFACs, the trauma kits, nor were they doing trauma active shooter training, and they didn't have the proper equipment. So I started a two-track process. One is to get our SROs up to speed on active shooter training and trauma medical, and two, to start messaging to everyone that they should, our SROs should belong to the sheriff's department or the local municipal departments, as is done in 113 other school districts in North Carolina. There are 115, let me say this again, there's 115 school districts in North Carolina covering 100 counties. 113 of those school districts, the school resource officers are provided by the sheriff's office and or municipal law enforcement. And there's good reason for that. Moore County stood alone with Charlotte Mecklenburg.
Yeah, lefty Charlotte Mecklenburg.
Right.
What a roster to be on.
Right. We don't want to model anything after Charlotte Mecklenburg and
Moore terrible
County.
Two.
So now after this transition, Charlotte, Moore County will join the rest of the school districts and counties in North Carolina, and Charlotte Mecklenburg schools and Mecklenburg County will stand alone as the only school district that have their SROs led by not professional law enforcement, but by school administrators.
Right.
And one other thing, look, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and someone breaks into your house, do you reach for your phone and call the school superintendent?
No, I don't even have them on speed dial.
Right. You call the sheriff's department.
Correct.
Same thing with school security.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now in Charlotte, I guess the only place more dangerous than the public schools will be the light rail.
But yes, yes.
Anyway, so let's move forward to the present and the big meeting. Two meetings, I guess, a work session a week ago, and then this past week, the regular business meeting of the school board. And all of a sudden, there's light at the end of the tunnel, and there's an agreement. A collaboration now between the school board, the administration of Moore County Schools, the new acting superintendent, and the sheriff's department. How did this happen?
So I can say that, you know, I cannot speak for Ms. Purvis, right? I can speak, you know, I know that most of the people in Moore, most of the elected officials in Moore County, I know that most, if not all, of the county commissioners thought that the SRO should go under the sheriff's department. I knew that I felt that way and strongly believe that way. I knew some board members felt that way. But the person, the most important person who didn't feel that way was Sheriff Fields. Right. And for whatever reason, and I had a very contentious conversation with him about 4 years ago, you know, pointing out that he should accept responsibility like 98 other sheriffs in North Carolina accept the responsibility of protecting our faculty, staff and students. He didn't see it that way. You know, he's an elected official, and as an elected official, no one was going to tell Sheriff Fields, you know, the county commissioners weren't, you know, well, they couldn't, but, you know, they weren't going to tell, you know, a fellow elected official. But, you know, to his credit, you know, Sheriff Fields, you know, obviously he thought about it. You know, there's been additional school shootings, you know, around the country. And for whatever reason, Sheriff Fields changed his mind and decided that, yes, indeed, the SROs are better off. And more importantly, the safety of our faculty, staff, and students is better off with the sheriff's department for any number of reasons. And hopefully we get into them and enumerate them. But for any number of reasons, Sheriff Fields finally came to the conclusion that the safety of our faculty, staff, and students is better under his watch.
And then, of course, no sooner does this story come out and this decision becomes announced, than the chattering class on social media, the hysterical chattering class, begins to immediately lament the fate of these student resource officers who are all going to lose their jobs and be thrust into poverty. Now, tell us why that is completely fictional.
Yeah, let me finish my previous thought, though. But you bring up a good thing. But so once Sheriff Fields decided, you know what, we're going to step up, and I think this is better under the sheriff's office, then everything else just fell into place, you know, because there's really no reason why it shouldn't be that way. Now, to your question about the what's going to happen with our existing SROs, you know, we labored with that. The school board labored with that. By the way, this could all be done in closed session, right? This happened in two closed sessions. It happened at the work session week before last, and then obviously this week. And it was legal to do so because you can handle personnel issues. You can handle purchasing land in closed session, and you can handle school safety and security. And you know, this transition clearly was underneath, you know, both personnel issues and school safety issues. So there was no violation of the law. You know, could have been a little more transparent. Yeah, you know, in hindsight, maybe, probably. But anyway, so let's talk about the existing SROs. An interesting fact about the school SROs is because the money comes from a different pot than the sheriff's department and municipal police departments. An interesting thing about Moore County School Police, and I think this was one of the motivating factors for creating it, was that if you retired from the sheriff's department or a municipal department, you could go to work for Moore County Schools, right? So we had 13 SROs, right? So first of all, under the sheriff, we're going to have 26, right? So we're going to have twice as many SROs, and Sheriff Fields have zero issues recruiting SROs because people want to work for the sheriff. I mean, law enforcement people don't want to work for, regardless of how good they are, doesn't want to work for a school superintendent, and they don't want to work for a feckless school board. They want to work for the sheriff and, you know, just everything the sheriff office has.
Yeah, an actual law enforcement entity.
Right, who, yeah, if God forbid something bad happens, you know, the superintendent, well, not the current one, but, you know, it is likely that a superintendent and a feckless school board would throw the officer under the bus, figuratively speaking, right?
Yes, indeed.
So anyway, you know, that was always part of our recruitment and retention issue, was who wants to work for a feckless school board if you're a law enforcement officer? Anyway, so back to your question. So we had we have two different buckets of officers. We have 13 total officers, five of which are eligible to be hired full-time by the sheriff's department. The other eight cannot be hired full-time by the sheriff's department because they already retired from the sheriff's department, right? So here's what we did. Let me point out a couple of things. One is the sheriff's department is committed to, you know, looking at and will most likely hire the five officers that they're eligible to hire, assuming there's not something in their background where the sheriff, you know, couldn't or wouldn't hire them, right? And those five people will remain in their same positions, right, in the same schools. So the five that are eligible to be hired by the sheriff's department, the sheriff is committed to hiring them, assuming there's not a bar to hiring them. And get this. They will make immediately $20,000 more a year. Plus the benefits for the sheriff's department are better than the ones offered through the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. For example, there's no copay for their medical, mm-hmm. which is probably another, if they got a family, another $500 a month.
Yeah, that's real money.
So the five SROs that will likely be transitioning to the sheriff's department, they're literally going to get a $26,000 a year pay raise. So what's the harm? You know, the left and the anarchist and all those people who, regardless of what happens in the schools or whatever progress is made, they're always against it, right? So, oh my God, we're mainstream. Okay, so let's talk about the other bucket of officers, right? So there's eight officers that are currently making, they've already retired from the sheriff's department. In Moore County schools, you know, they're probably making, I don't know, $44,000 to $48,000 a year. That's a guess. That's about average, right? So let's just call it $48,000 a year. They can work, and Sheriff Fields is committed to hiring them, you know, and they can work part-time for the sheriff's department up to 1,000 hours per year. So they can make, so picture these numbers in your mind. They're currently making, let's say, $48,000 a year working full-time, which is 2,000 hours a year, right? They can work for the sheriff's department being an SRO, you know, games, filling in for vacation, filling in for leave, you know, normal rotation, $34 an hour, 1,000 hours a year. So they can work part-time for the sheriff's department making almost as much as they did working full-time for Moore County Schools.
So a good deal all the way around.
Yeah, and then to make it better, right, and this was, I insisted on this. First of all, we're giving them 9 months' notice, right, so they can plan transition and think about what they want to do. And for those that stay until we do the transaction or transition, we're going to give them 3 months' severance pay. So we have effectively given these officers a year's notice.
Yeah.
With severance pay.
Right.
But we'll just call them the bitching class. The bitching class who, you know, anytime there's any progress, you know, they bitched when we restored the spelling bee. They bitched when we eliminated student violence. They bitched when
we brought back the valedictorian.
The valedictorian, salutatorians. Yeah. Oh, they can't do that. We can't have merit in our schools. They bitched when we did the Parental Bill of Rights, which was really nothing more than saying, public employees cannot keep secrets from parents about their minor. These people bitch about everything because really what they want to do is they want to set the clock back to when we had a woke strategic plan. There was no merit. There were no valedictorians. There was, you know, the students were running amok. These people are nuts and they'll bitch about anything regardless. Even if it's a win-win-win, they'll bitch about it.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable and breathtaking.
What's remarkable is that people listen to them.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a whole nother story.
Luckily, not a lot of people.
Well, it's because we're not getting the message out is the problem. There's no counter to their propaganda on social media.
Well, because, you know, some people have, I don't know, careers and jobs and responsibilities.
Right.
And they don't spend 18 hours a day, you know.
Drinking cheap vodka and smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, and posting replies to other people's posts.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, there's a real world out there, believe it or not. Well, and the good news is, let's not bury the headline, beginning, I guess, January 2027,
yep.
Every Moore County Public School will be guarded by an armed, trained security person,
so
individual.
That's when the sheriff, just one correction, yes, the sheriff will take responsibility the 1st of January of 2027. He has to recruit and train a cadre of SROs, and he's given himself up to 14 months to do that. Right. So but here's my prediction. So a couple of things. So on 1 January, we'll have at least as many SROs as we already have, although it's my understanding Sheriff Fields has already started getting SRO training for some of his existing deputies who, they're just tired of being on the road, or maybe they have a family situation. You know, their wife has an illness or their husband has an illness. So, get them off the road. So anyway, Sheriff Fields has given himself 14 months, but here's what I suspect. I strongly suspect that when the sheriff's department takes over the SRO department, I think that people will be lining up to fill out applications to be an SRO under the leadership of Sheriff Fields and his team. That's what I believe. So even though he's given himself 14 months, my guess is by the end of the spring semester, we'll be pretty close to having an SRO in every school, but that's my speculation.
And let's shift gears real quickly in the time we have left. And a reminder that coming up, we'll be talking with Keisha Brassington of the Republican National Committee, our North Carolina rep to that committee. Another interesting development that came up in the past week, and this has occurred in other states already, and now it may be coming to Morrill County. There is a proclamation, a resolution on the table to declare the month of June as Nuclear Family Month, recognizing the importance of the nuclear stable family that most of us grew up in a long ago and far away place. And this is apparently expected to be adopted by the Moore County Board of Commissioners. And I think it's great. You know, we've got Pride Month and we've got all these other months. Why not celebrate the nuclear American family and all of the benefits that go hand in hand with that? I think it's a great development. And I know that one of our school board candidates, Jim Peterson, is definitely behind one of the backers of this. Of course, it's a resolution. It's somewhat of a symbolic thing. But why shouldn't we do that?
No, it sends the right message because, yeah. Look, the left all, they want their gay pride. Look, let me say this. I'm actually opposed to any sort of identity politics. I don't care. The minute that you point out one group of people, whether it's their ethnicity or their religion or their gender or whatever, the minute you point one out, you're leaving someone else out. That's the point the left never gets. So I'm in favor of getting all that crap out of our schools. No Hispanic Week, no Black History Month. Let's just have Math Month. Let's have Pi Day. Let's celebrate and elevate, things related to our mission. But the point of this is, look, if the left can have Gay Pride Month, why can't we have Nuclear Family Month? But they'll go nuts and they'll riot in the streets because we want to have Nuclear Family Month. But then they're the ones who created all this identity politics BS by, Gay Pride Week and this and that and the next thing.
Yeah.
And we ought to just eliminate it all. But, if they're going to have their little observations, then us people of traditional values, we can have our observations.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, just earlier this year in nearby Tennessee, the governor there, a Republican, of course, Bill Lee, signed a resolution that replaces Pride Month in Tennessee with the Nuclear Family Month. So this is maybe it's trending. And I think that Moore County ought to be a part of that trend because, no matter what the left would have you believe, if you look at the voter registration data in this county, the Democrats are a decided minority and they're not even close. There's 32,000 unaffiliated voters. There's 34,000 Republican eligible voters, and there's about 15,000 Democrats. So give me a break. Enough is enough.
Yeah, it's crazy, and good. I hope that our county commissioners step up and I hope they pass the resolution. I will be there and stand up and clap when they pass that.
Joining us now is Keisha Brassington. She is North Carolina's committee woman representing our state. within the greater Republican National Committee. Good morning, Keisha.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Tell us a little bit about your roles and responsibilities as the committee woman representing our state among the greater Republican National Committee apparatus.
Well, the RNC is made up of 168 members. Those 168 members are your National Committee man, National Committee woman, and the state chair. Those three people go to the national level and make up the 168 members of the RNC. Our job really is to do the business of the party for our state Republicans, which would be platform, plan of organization, resolutions, but also running a $1 billion budget. So those are some of the things that we do. We do have three required national meetings a year and then two regional meetings a year. But on top of that, we can make the job whatever we want that to be. And here in North Carolina, I have chosen to really represent the women in North Carolina in helping them run for office. So that's really our job in a nutshell at the RNC.
And that segues very naturally into the Women's Leadership Initiative, which you have launched and which you are leading, and which recently completed its first summit in the Charlotte area. The Women's Leadership Initiative has three primary objectives: to support current conservative women elected to the General Assembly in North Carolina, and to identify, train, and support conservative women who are candidates to run for office in the General Assembly. We always need to keep our bench of talent ready to go. And then finally, to lobby and support female-friendly and family-friendly legislation in Raleigh. So, coming out of your initial summit, Keisha, tell us about you know, where you go from here and what we can expect.
Well, I tell you, the reason I formed Women's Leadership Initiative is because there is a real need in the state of North Carolina for conservative Republican women to run for office, and specifically the General Assembly. North Carolina ranks in the bottom 3% in the nation with female conservative representation. We only have 4% representation in the state Senate and 12% representation in the House in North Carolina. So we need to do better. What's happening in the state is, especially in Democrat cities, they see a close seat, say it's, you know, a close 50-50 kind of race. They run a Democrat woman and they take that seat. And I've specifically seen that happen here in Mecklenburg County, where we've had 3 to 4 state House seats taken over by Democrat women. So I formed this PAC for Republican women to run for office and hopefully take over some of those seats at the General Assembly so we can make those numbers look a little bit better and hold those seats in Raleigh. We did have our very first inaugural summit this past Friday at Ballantyne. What we're doing is supporting 20 women running for office, 20 female candidates that can run up to the General Assembly level. And we will walk alongside them for a full year as we have training classes, we have special dinners, we'll go to the General Assembly and work and train with General Assembly members so that hopefully these ladies will run for office and take back some of those seats.
And they would, if they end up campaigning and running for a seat, that would be for which cycle in leading up to 2028, or when would that?
It would be 2028. Some of our candidates are mayoral candidates, city council, commissioner candidates, and we will walk alongside them even longer so that potentially in the future they will run for the General Assembly. But we are also working with the House caucus and the Senate caucus so that we work in line together. That's what we need to do, is really form a big team. And this is a long-term project.
Yeah, you got to play the long game.
That's right.
That's what the left has done for a long.
That's it.
For many decades. Now we see all around the country a lot of organizations that came out of the, for example, the pandemic, like Moms for Liberty.
Yes.
And very powerful in terms of influence organizations, and it stands to reason that a lot of these people who are volunteering essentially would make, you know, very, very formidable candidates. They just kind of need to know how to do it. Isn't that what it comes down to?
They need to know how to do it, but they also need to know how to operate once they get it done.
Right.
Working at the General Assembly, working as a county commissioner, working on the city council, it takes more than just being an advocate or a grassroots activist. Having that activism needs to translate to real service and real policy. So that's something that we also work with them on. Taking that activism and just being an activist in Raleigh does not mean that you can be a legislator. So that's an excellent point that you point out. That's those are things we're working with these ladies also on.
So one of the things that you mentioned when you visited Moore County recently to speak at the Moore Republican Women's Club luncheon,
yes,
I believe, which I was in attendance, you mentioned that one of the specific goals of the North Carolina GOP plan of organization is to address basically fake Republicans or rhinos, Republicans in name only, filing to run as Republicans. How do we guard against that from happening?
That's a big problem. That is the new Democrat strategy. And we have always got to be very aware of what they're doing because they always have something new that's going to pop up. And then we've got to fight and protect against that. So what you're seeing is you're seeing Democrats switch their registration at the last minute to run as Republicans to mess up primaries. We literally have a Sharia law Democrat liberal with the full face burqa that won a Republican primary in the Raleigh area. That just cannot happen. And definitely the party cannot support someone like that. That completely goes against our Republican agenda. So what we need to do, in my opinion, is we need to have people that have, if they switch from Democrat to Republican, that they have voted Republican and pulled Republican ballots in, say, two or three Republican primaries and pulled those Republican ballots, and then the party can support them. But if they are switching and running in that cycle, in my opinion, I don't think the Republican Party should promote or work with that candidate yet.
So you're saying that in the recent March primary, that
yes,
a Sharia law advocating Democrat,
yes,
switched registration and is now running as a Republican in the fall.
Yes.
And they won. They won the Republican primary.
Yes,
that's the insane
and it
part.
It was national news in a black full face burqa. Everything that the Republican Party is not.
So how do we combat that? Do we vote for the Democrat in the fall, or what are we supposed to do?
I don't know if there's a Democrat on the ballot in the fall, or
gosh,
if she will be elected a Republican and then maybe switch back to Democrat. I'm not sure about that.
Oh,
but
wow,
we absolutely do not need to, of course, in any way support that race. That's just women's rights, human rights. I just cannot advocate for that whatsoever. It's everything that we aren't. But those are the gains we're going to have to wake up to. And they are working with that on the North Carolina plan of organization. And then our counties need to work with that also.
Right, because it's not exactly like they're doing it under the cover of darkness. I mean, they're rather blatant about it.
They are, but then we have to be careful because we have our wonderful state auditor, Dave Boliak, who,
yes,
was a Democrat who switched to Republican. So we have to be very careful, and we don't want to block Democrats who are sick of the Democrat Party. They are not extreme liberals, and they say, I identify more with Republicans. So it's going to be a fine line that we have to cover. I think personally, maybe pulling a Republican ballot in two different cycles could then qualify you for GOP support.
Yeah. Well, we did see that transition several years ago with, is it Tricia Cotham?
We did. She saved our party. She has, and she gives us conservative votes. She's right here in Mint Hill in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And boy, did she get hatred from her previous side of the aisle. I'm surprised. I mean, they were burning her in effigy.
Yes. And she has small children, and they were at her home.
Yep.
Well, yeah, they're nothing if not...
Yeah. Violent,
so there
will be
ruthless
exceptions.
Yeah. Well, that's encouraging. That really is. So given your continuous exposure to all of the folks within the North Carolina GOP, What is the mood? You know, because there's this narrative, which drives me crazy, that, you know, if there are Republicans in power during a midterm election cycle, that the Democrats are always going to win. I'm not buying that. And what is the feeling within the North Carolina Republican Party
First of all, with President Trump, you can throw anything and everything out the window. Nothing counts when it's a President Trump cycle. Nothing is traditional in a President Trump cycle. I also think we're going to see some big momentum. We have the 250th anniversary, July 4th. And then we're going to have a midterm convention, which we've never had before, in August, probably in Texas, where we're going to highlight all of the wins across the country. And you can believe Michael Whatley will have a big presence on that midterm convention stage. And in that midterm convention, we're going to be able to highlight all of Trump's wins. The things that we've done that the media is not talking about is going to be front and center. I really think we're going to do fine in North Carolina. We've got to win the U.S. Senate race. It's just like I said in the meeting in Moore County. This is about our counties. It's about our state. It's about our country. But even more than that, it's about the international world. And we've got to deliver the U.S. Senate seat in North Carolina so we can really protect that America First agenda.
And to your point, Whatley's opponent, Roy Cooper, it's not like he doesn't have a record. The guy's never had a job. All he's done is run for office and managed to win a lot. But, he's got a pretty checkered record as governor, I would say. No question about it.
And previous to governor as the attorney general. Much of the violence that we're seeing in North Carolina now, we managed to quell it in Moore County schools. But the violence we see in our school systems, the violence we see in Charlotte, that's a direct result of his policies as both the attorney general and as subsequent as governor.
You are 100% correct. And this is what I hope. I hope that for this U.S. Senate seat, that as classic Republicans, we don't play nice. Take the gloves off. Fight hard. Punch them with the right, punch them with the left, and then get them straight in the face. Because we have to win this race. No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Well, you're talking to the right team here. Steve and I'll enlist for that.
Exactly. Well, Keisha Brassington, we thank you very much for joining us this morning and for inspiring us and for all of the energy and time that you deliver to the Republican Party and specifically with the new Women's Leadership Initiative. Thanks again, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
David, you know, Keisha brought up an excellent point as we wrapped up our conversation with her regarding the upcoming showdown for U.S. Senate between Republican Michael Whatley and Democrat and former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. And I do think that, you know, Whatley has got some really low-hanging fruit when it comes to going after Cooper's record and winning this important Senate race. It's just a matter of execution, really.
Yeah, you know, as Keisha pointed out, Cooper, or as I refer to him, Pooper, he has, you know, he's got a record. And part of it, I mean, it ranges, you know, choose an item, you know, is lockdown during COVID. I mean, it's endless. But one I want to talk about was his insistence on passage of the juvenile justice reform, right? That was passed 7 or 8 years ago, and right before I got elected to the school board, and a couple of years before I got elected to the school board. And if you remember back to the Obama administration, you know, the buzzword was, and who was his attorney general? Obama's
Eric Holder.
This was Eric Holder's deal. Radical leftist Eric Holder. We got to break the school to prison pipeline. So they implemented this juvenile justice. And oddly enough, North Carolina was one of the last states to implement it. And it was like a decade after, you know, Obama left office. But for somehow Cooper got that shepherded through the Berger's Senate, right? I don't know why Berger always kowtowed to the Democrat governor, but that's what we had. But anyway, the juvenile justice quote-unquote reform, basically it made it impossible to hold anyone under 18 accountable for crimes they committed. That's how we lost control of our students in our schools. And if you look out and you see this horrible academic of teen violence, where they're, you know, fighting in the streets, killing each other, you know, you see 14, 15, 16 year old kids killing people. Well, that's because the drug lords, the criminal bosses, they understand that it doesn't matter how horrific of a crime a juvenile, especially a juvenile under 17, commits. There's going to be nothing past the age 18. So this juvenile justice reform that Cooper insisted get passed, it set it up so we lost control of our students. You got 14, 15, 16 year olds creating murder, rapes, because they know that the worst they'll get is a 3-year sentence. And the minute they turn 18, not only will they be released from, you know, juvenile justice system, but their record will also be cleaned. So, you know, Cooper's got a record, and Cooper's responsible for a lot of the bad stuff that's happened in North Carolina. And, you know, hopefully the Whatley campaign will remind people of that. We shall see.
And it's not like as these minors become adults that they automatically become Boy Scouts once they, you know, hit their early 20s.
They just start their adult crime career.
They go onto the Charlotte light rail system and slash the neck of a blonde Ukrainian immigrant. That's
right.
What they do.
Yeah. Isn't it ironic that an immigrant, you know, a Ukrainian lady and her family flee the violence, flee the Russian shelling and killing of Ukrainian citizens, comes to the United States to live a safer life, only to get stabbed in a Chicago light rail by a guy that had been arrested, 35 times and set free by a bunch of liberal district attorneys?
Yeah, a staggering number of times that he had been arrested and released over and over and over
and again. They just found him not competent
to mentally
stand trial.
That'll
be his 36th. His 36th time that he will get off will be stabbing that Ukrainian refugee on a Chicago's light rail.
Of course, the reason that Michael Whatley is running for the U.S. Senate seat as our Republican candidate is because the incumbent, Tom Tillis, is not seeking re-election and is seeking to step away from the political limelight. But boy, he's not going quietly, and he seems to really thrive on his second guessing and armchair quarterbacking of all things Trump and the Trump administration. And of course, in the middle of this military engagement in Iran, long overdue, decades overdue, Tillis runs to not even Fox News, he runs to NBC News to get his little 2 cents worth in on the state of affairs with the Trump administration and our current engagement in Iran. Let's play clip 2.
60 days is important with respect to the War Powers Resolution. And I'm not quite clear what the strategic objectives are. And so as we get closer to the 60-day mark, they may request a 30-day extension, as long as that's accompanied with a lot of details that I haven't seen to this point and intentionally did not get into. It's going to be difficult to get my support.
Can I just run through a few people around the president, and you can tell me if they've been giving him bad or good advice? Mm-hmm. Stephen Miller.
Bad advice.
Tulsi Gabbard, good advice, bad advice?
Gabbard is kind of like no advice. I mean, honestly, I just haven't seen her around.
What about the vice president, J.D. Vance? Good advice, bad advice?
You know, I don't know. It's harder for me to judge exactly what role J.D.'s playing in advising the president.
Pete Hegseth.
Trending bad advice. You know, the United States is not a warmonger. We go in and try and end wars. We try not to start them, right? And I thought that's just an example of where he gets caught up on the war thing and him being the top warrior.
What was your reaction when you saw the president's post, multiple of them calling for the annihilation of Iranians?
I didn't even get a chance to react. I got a flood of text from people that were very concerned. And
your constituents?
Everything from constituents to friends to family members, you know, just people going, what's going on? Because, I mean, that was pretty profound.
He said, he doesn't regret it because it got the Iranians to the table.
Well, that's what I mean. But that proves the point, that I don't think that he had any intention of destroying civilization. I think there are a variety of reasons why that would never happen of Iran. But I think if I were coaching him, I'd say, Mr. President, people believe literally every word that comes out of your mouth.
Oh, I'm sure that's exactly what President Trump wants, is coaching from Tom Tillis. And by the way, he mentioned that he accuses the United States of starting a war with Iran. Iran, through its proxies, has been waging war on innocent people for decades through terror organizations like Hezbollah in Lebanon. So don't tell me that Iran hasn't been waging war, and don't tell me that we're not going in there to try to put a stop to it once and for all, because that's the reality.
So, you know, what a piece of crap Tillis is. I don't know how to put it any clearer, but, you know, just listen to him. He said the U.S. ends wars, not starts them. So, okay, who started the war in Iran? Who started the war in Afghanistan? Who started all these other wars, right? Who ended them? Trump has ended and implemented more peace. Now, what Trump has done is he's the first president. Carter didn't deal with the Iranians. Nobody between Carter and Biden dealt with the Iranians. They all said they would, and blah, blah, blah. There were resolutions passed. Trump took action.
Well, Obama dealt with them by sending them
billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars to appease them.
Cash. Same thing with Biden. Billions and billions of dollars.
That's a war crime if ever there was one.
And then look at Tillis's assessment. First of all, he goes and appears, you know, supposedly Tillis is a Republican. We know he's not. He's a Republican like Berger was a Republican, right? They're not Republicans. They're rhinos, right? So, secondly, listen to his characterization of Trump's cabinet. Miller, bad advice. Miller's a brilliant individual. You know, you may not agree with his political views, but Stephen Miller is a brilliant man who gives Trump great advice. Gabbard, none. I don't see her anywhere. I see Gabbard everywhere. Gabbard is involved. She's engaged. And, you know, I don't know what advice she's given Trump, but Tillis's characterization of her not being engaged, that's 100% false.
Don't forget, she left the Democrat Party, and now she's a steady hand in the Trump administration.
Right, right. And that's what makes that. That's why Tillis has to bash her, because, you know, in his mind, she's a turncoat from his uniparty.
Yeah.
Right. Tillis is a uniparty guy. He's right. Not a Republican. He's not a leftist. He's not a conservative. He's not a leftist. He's a uniparty. It's what's in it to enrich him and his cronies. That's the way he was in North Carolina, and that's the way he is in the Senate.
And when it comes to the Vice President, J.D. Vance, it appears to me all indications are that President Trump thinks of him as a very worthy and capable partner.
Right. I wonder what, you know... Tillis said it's hard to see what Vance is doing. I wonder what Tillis's view of Vice President Harris was.
Yeah.
Oh, she was great. She gave great advice. You know, she's
was the border czar.
Right, yeah. Right. And then Hegseth, bad advice. You know, that's nonsense. They've done more to reform the Department of Defense, especially the acquisition, than anyone else has. You know, the difference between Trump, and this is what makes the uniparty politicians mad, is that Trump and his team are not afraid to address issues and to resolve them. And politicians, the uniparty politicians, Republican Democrats, are not used to, nor do they want, elected officials who actually address issues and fix them, because they make money off of perpetuating the fraud, perpetuating the favoritism, perpetuating the waste. That's what really gets people like Tillis mad.
Let's switch gears in the time that we have remaining. There was a big bombshell in the past week regarding the generically named Southern Poverty Law Center, which has been around since 1971. Whatever it started out seeking to accomplish, it has gone way off the rails over the decades. And now we come to find out that that not only has the Southern Poverty Law Center been well funded by any number of dark entities, but they've actually been using their largesse to keep the engines of racism humming, so that they have a reason to exist. And it's worse than that. They have also made it their business to identify organizations and individuals on what they call their hate list, and this has had a consequence or two that cannot be ignored. And in fact, if you listen to the member of the U.S. House from Tennessee, Republican Andy Ogles, he cuts right to the chase on this. Play clip one.
People need to understand that this conspiracy that was built by the left to paint the right as racist and Nazi and violent is totally fabricated. So that begs the question, this heat map that they created, this vile contempt for Republicans, how did that, you know, play into Charlie Kirk's murder? Were they there on January 6th? Like, you have millions upon millions of dollars. I mean, even in Nashville, you had the Patriot Front. They were posing as Nazis, marching in Nashville, right? You have a conservative organization, several in my district, that are on this heat map of being, you know, the alt-right hate groups. It's an incestuous octopus. The tentacles are spread all throughout the left. Look, they're... This is a criminal enterprise that's been undermining our republic. And again, kudos to the DOJ for going after this. And really, I mean, this, it can't be lost, ladies and gentlemen. When you think about the murder of Charlie Kirk, when you think about some of these hate crimes that have happened across this country, would they have happened had it not been for this vile rhetoric from the left?
And, you know, Charlie Kirk and Turning Point USA were placed on that hate list about 4 months before Charlie was assassinated in September of last year on the campus of Utah Valley University. 4 months, and Charlie didn't back down from the Southern Poverty Law Center. When they put his organization on the list, he called him out. He went on his own radio show, as well as Fox News and other places, and called him out for being, you know, the thugs and the frauds that they are. And, you know, I don't know. Somebody was motivated to shoot and kill Charlie Kirk. Why they were motivated to do that, maybe we'll never know. But you could definitely connect the dots there.
Let me. So first of all, you know, I'd forgotten about the Southern Poverty Law Center until, you know, they got in the news. And I got to say, I went to their website last night to make sure that I was not listed, and neither you nor I were listed. But the point
now
is, what they do is, anyone who disagrees with them ideologically, who's effective, they call them hate, you know, Nazis, all this other stuff, and then they just demonize and attack them. So hopefully there'll be civil suits. Hopefully these federal indictments will lead to civil lawsuits, and they'll get sued into oblivion. But here's the other thing I want to say about the incestuous tentacles that organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center have. As you know, my company, we used to sponsor the FBI National Academy Associates, which is the state and local people who attend, law enforcement who attend the FBI National Academy, and they have state associations. They have retrainers every year in each state, and for years I attended those retrainers, and I was shocked to find in all these law enforcement training things, inevitably they have the Southern Poverty Law Center giving our seminar, and they just sat up there and spewed everyone's racist, everyone this and that, and they were they literally had people going out and giving seminars to cops to brainwash them to their leftist stuff. And if you remember, about a year ago when Trump first got in office, the Department of Justice severed all relationships with organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center. That was specifically to keep them from giving all these endless seminars to law enforcement officers trying to brainwash them. It's crazy what was happening in our country, and I witnessed it firsthand.
Well, I'm glad that I've had a chance to witness you in the big chair again
here
this week.
Yes,
welcome
sir.
Back, David. I am Steve Woodward. He is David Hensley. Come back and join us again next Saturday when we will be
taking
aim.